Hi, Glenn.
Hey there, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm happy. I'm with my children at Christmas time, and you know, I've completed a semester's worth of drudgery, and looking forward to a few weeks of time to myself. And I'm doing okay.
I'm sure you've earned it.
Yeah.
thanks for taking the time out.
Sure.
So this is, although we are taping this with about, I don't know, 36 hours or something left in the new year, it will actually appear right after, at the dawn of the new year. And for that reason, it's going to be a prospective more than retrospective discussion in principle.
Okay.
We're not going to make predictions, but we're going to try to talk about some things we hope might happen. And I guess maybe some things we hope won't happen in the new year, in the future generally.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, in case there's anyone, and I doubt there's anyone who would watch or listen to Blogging Heads who doesn't know who you are, of course, Glenn Lowry, host of The Glenn Show on Blogging Heads, and a noted public intellectual and economics professor at Brown University.
Thank you. That's who I am.
And I'm Robert Wright, and that's who I am. We're ready. What are your hopes? Do you have hopes? Do you have fears?
Do I have hopes? Well, I guess I'm hoping that our government, the president and the Congress, will find a way of being able to get a little bit more done effectively than has been the case in recent years.
That's a pretty low bar.
Yeah, well, but there's no guarantee that it's going to be surpassed.
No.
I think it's still worth hoping for. I gather there's some straws in the wind that are positive in that respect. I mean, the president has taken the initiatives that he's taken on behalf of salvaging, you know, his legacy and so forth and asserting himself with or without the Congress. But I gather, I'm no expert here, that Republican leadership are feeling some pressure to show that, you know, the party is capable of governing, not just saying no to Obama. And so I assume legislation will be enacted and the president may or may not sign it into law. But I'm hopeful about that. At least that's something I'm hoping will happen.
Yeah, I guess controlling both houses just puts a little more pressure on you. It's harder to blame the other guys then. And I guess that's the main basis of the hope.
Yeah.
Is that it? Yeah. And of course, Obama, you know, he's got to be thinking legacy at this point. So he's certainly motivated to get some things accomplished that he'll be proud of. I can imagine the danger that in pursuing that, he will do so many things unilaterally, as he's already been accused of doing, you know, with respect to immigration, maybe to some extent with Cuba, that he could antagonize the Republicans sufficiently to complicate relations. I don't know. But as you say, they have some intrinsic motivation.
Yes.
So what would you want them to do most of all if they did actually do something?
Immigration, tax reform, getting affordable care on a agreed upon solid foundation. And I'm not an expert in the field, but I gather that that may require some modification. I guess it's also going to depend on what the Supreme Court does.
Mm-hmm.
And not killing the recovery, not doing anything stupid, shutting down the government, creating doubt about whether we're going to meet our financial obligations and things of this kind, anything that would upset what looks like a delicate but hopeful turn on the economic front.
Yeah, right now the recovery in the U.S. seems sufficiently strong that you could be hopeful. I guess one thing I wonder about is that the prospects abroad in various places seem sufficiently shaky. You know, China even, and certainly places like Russia and to some extent Europe. That if the world is as interdependent as we are told it is, you might worry that there's only so far the U.S. can go with its own momentum and eventually the ills of the rest of the world will catch up with it. But you're an economist, so you know better than I do.
Yeah, well, I don't know with any high degree of confidence. I'm not that kind of economist, more social economics than macroeconomics. But yeah, I'm reading the same stuff that you're reading, and the dark clouds have to do with what happens in China, where there seems to be a slowdown afoot what happens in Europe, where they've not yet, if I believe Paul Krugman, gotten over the austerity delusion, and where, you know, we, as you say, interdependency, and, you know, we all kind of rise or fall together. So, but yeah. I'm afraid, Bob, I can do nothing but mouth platitudes about this issue and not give you any real expertise.
it's a living, Glenn. It's a living. There are people paid much, people getting paid much more than you and I are getting paid to mouth platitudes, and their platitudes are even more platitudinous.
That's well put, Bob. I agree.
but so
I'm not
maybe,
complaining, you know.
Here's a question. You mentioned immigration. This is actually a question that occurred to me while I was listening to a conversation between you and John McWhorter on Blogging Heads.
Yeah.
And you were talking about Ferguson.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, as some people have said, I think the protest is about more than police brutality. It's an expression of frustration with a number of things, including the economic status of many African Americans,
right.
I think. And there is this argument, you know, Mickey Kaus, you, I don't know if you know him personally, but he, of course, was a co-founder of Blogging Heads, and he kind of writes about immigration 24/7, and he adopts the conservative position. And a big part of his reasoning is that immigrants, especially from Latin America, compete with low income blacks for jobs in America. And he thinks that, you know, if we're going to see significant rise in the economic fortunes of low-income blacks, it would help to have less competition from Latin American immigrants. So, again, you're an economist. This, too, may not be your area of expertise, but do you have a view on that question?
I do. This is a little closer to my area of expertise. I don't actually do research on immigration, but I do teach from time to time, you know, labor economics and income distribution and inequality and, you know, race and economics kind of courses. And from my reading the literature and thinking about this, I have come to the view that there is definitely some competitive dynamic that goes on at the kind of relatively low-skilled, relatively low-wage end of the labor market in a lot of urban areas where, there are only so many jobs to go around. It's kind of hard to think as an economist that there wouldn't be this mm-hmm. kind of effect. The question is, how big is it? There are a variety of different kinds of studies that are out there that attempt to measure the effect. And there are people, I think of George Borjas as one, he's only one, an economist at Harvard at the Kennedy School, who's been writing about this most of his life. He happens himself to be a Cuban immigrant, and his position tends to be critical of open borders. And, he's amassed quite a bit of evidence that I find to be relatively persuasive on this question. So it's a politically delicate thing because, you know, we're people of color here together and, we're the majority of minorities and we're all kind of Democrats here. We blacks and Latinos, and we know what the Fox News crowd and the conservative Republicans want to do. They want to build a wall at the border and keep all the Latin Americans out. So we're supposed to be against that. And it's kind of verboten to delve too deeply into this, you know, concern, to show too much worry about it. I think it's a real factor. And I don't know, how to quantify, but I think the evidence overall is pretty convincing that there is a negative consequence for employment opportunities for, let's call them indigenous, low-skilled people, not just blacks, but blacks are disproportionate in that population, of the, competition that they're getting in the labor market from immigrants who come here and who come here looking for work. I whether that adds up to opposing, liberalization of immigration law, I'm not saying that. That's not my position. But just on the effect, as an economist, as a social scientist, just on what's the sign, what's the direction of the effect, I think it's pretty clear that it's not helpful.
But on balance, it sounds like you still come out for immigration reform of a somewhat liberal variety.
Well, I do. I mean, you know, just based on a kind of humanitarian concern, we've got these people here in the millions. They're not going anywhere. We've got all these various heartbreaking and tragic cases about kids being citizens, parents not, and all that. You know, we're not going to deport these people. There does need to be some regularization of their status. I'd like to see that matter. Like to see that matter dealt with. I mean, you know, there are costs associated with it, and amongst those costs might be some, you know, negative effect on employment opportunities for Native American workers. But overall, you know, I think doing some kind of reform of the system is indicated, and it's way past time, and for all the reasons that the advocates are pointing to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Okay.
But among the things that I don't, you know, you say, what do we want to see or hope for? What do we hope doesn't happen? One of the things that I hope doesn't happen, you've mentioned Ferguson, is that this rift or conflict between, quote, communities of color and the police, mm-hmm. I certainly hope that it does not become a narrative of, you know, the argument and debate about domestic policy and policing and crime and safety in our cities and race relations going forward. I don't know how we're going to do it, but I somehow hope we can get past this confrontational moment. And, you know, God knows I don't want to see a repetition of the violence against police officers, such as what was enacted in New York City last week. And of course, I mean, it shouldn't need to be said, but I'll say it. I don't want to see more young black men gunned down in the street, though. You know, I think it's quite likely that there are going to be other such incidents of police shootings of people in difficult circumstances as the police try to do their jobs in the cities and, you know, confront the circumstances that they confront. And the police are not blameless, so there are going to be cases in which people are going to have complaints about police brutality and so forth. I'm certain that that will happen. But nationalizing it, racializing it, and making it into a cause celeb that then becomes a sort of focal point for conflict, I hope that that is not the path that we are on.
Yeah, I know in your conversation with John McWhorter, you expressed the concern that there could be a kind of a positive feedback cycle that all of this would maybe ironically make police, if anything, more reactive in dicey situations, more inclined to use their guns somehow. And then that would lead to more protests, possibly of a violent kind. And so, and then, you know, it would just, everything would spiral.
Well, that right? Yeah, that's the worst case scenario, I think. I mean, I can see a cop saying, it's open season on police now. They're shooting police, sitting in their cars, doing nothing in New York City. There's all this anger mm-hmm. out there against police. There's all this, you know, I mean, in the Ferguson civil disturbances that took place after the grand jury's non-indictment and after the immediate event where there was some rioting and looting, I mean, police were being pelted with projectiles. They were being spat upon and cursed and taking gunfire. And you can see a tendency, and not only in the New York City police union leadership, but elsewhere in policing around the country, of a kind of circling the wagons, war on police, police don't get no respect and such like that. And mm-hmm. and because there are daily these kinds of incidents, conflict, violent encounters, crime, and, you know, countering criminal activity, there will be a myriad number of opportunities where the police have this discretion about the use of force or not. And yeah, it's entirely possible that they might be fortified in their determination to make sure that they're not going home in a box so on. So, and as you say, you know, the consequence of that could be Michael Brown-like incidents, which could then fuel protests and so forth.
Yeah.
So no, that's not a pretty picture in my mind.
I mean, you might think that the shooting of those police officers in New York could have a kind of inhibiting effect on some forms of protest. I mean, you noted in that conversation this chant that they were apparently doing in a march that had been organized by Al Sharpton. I don't know if he could hear the chant from where he was. Right. Maybe you do. But the thing about how, what do we want dead cops? When do we want them now? This was before the shooting of the police officers. Right. You might think that that would be less likely to happen now. I mean, in the wake of this, but maybe that's too optimistic.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the end of that. That it's less likely that having happened.
You might think that protesters would be less inclined now that we have seen two policemen actually killed. You might think that sort of irresponsible behavior would decline. I mean, the that kind of chant at a protest march.
Oh yeah, and, right. Exactly. I wouldn't expect to hear that kind of chant at a protest march again. Although when de Blasio called upon protesters to allow a respite during this period when the officers are being buried, one funeral is taking place, the other is to come, to kind of put a hold on the protest, I gathered just from reading the newspapers that the answer was no. We won't put a hold on the protest. I don't know that social media are a reliable source of information here, but from what I've been reading on my Facebook and other accounts from people, I've heard a lot of comment that, you know, nothing has changed. I mean, that the protest energy shouldn't be quieted because of these events. You know, people don't want to be tarred with, you know, the acts of a deranged lone wolf who does something horrible.
Right.
They don't want that to be, you know, to redound to the discredit of the movement overall. So they're trying to say it doesn't have anything to do with us. But yeah, I guess I would say that, you know, if people are organizing to go out in March, they're less likely to now call for what do we want, dead cops, given that we've got some dead cops on hand.
Yeah, I got to say, the situation in New York is kind of disturbing, including the other side of it. Those police officers who turned their back during the funeral while the mayor was talking. I mean, you know, it's, of course, the situation isn't exactly analogous to the situation in the military with their commander in chief, the president. But if something like that happened in the military, you would start getting really alarmed, right? I mean, that's like, you know, if they basically started saying we do not respect the political leadership.
That's right.
That would be really scary. And this bothers me in somewhat the same way, although maybe it shouldn't. Maybe the parallel, you know, for some reason is I should not really pursue. So,
it's suggestive. I don't think it's an exact parallel. I mean, as I'm sure you're aware, because, you know, the president is ordering the military to do something, go into combat or whatever it is. And there's a chain of command issue, and there just can't be any doubt about the impeccability of that. You know, the president is the commander in chief and they do what he tells them to do. And if we've got grousing in the military ranks that suggests that they might not do what he tells them to do, that's an absolutely horrid situation. I don't think New York City policing is quite at that level. But the rift between the mayor and the police department is deeply troubling. And the kind of latent conflict over values, where the mayor runs against the policies of Michael Bloomberg and before him Rudy Giuliani, and he says policing is too heavy-handed, and he identifies explicitly with minority community concerns about over policing and overly aggressive policing. On the one hand, that's a question in the election, and he gets elected. So now the police department who are under political control and for whom these discretionary policies are choices that policymakers get to make. How much stop and frisk do we do? How aggressive? What are the protocols and so on? What I was saying to people when they were complaining about stop and frisk in New York City, Ray Kelly, who was then the police commissioner in New York City a few years ago. He came here to Brown to give a lecture, and he got shouted down by students who said that the policies were racist, to which my response to the students, I'm a big free speech guy, I don't like seeing people get shouted down, is, yeah, he's wrong. Ray Kelly is wrong. Let's have an election. You know, he's wrong. Let's make an argument. Let's argue with him. Let's have an election, and let's change the policy. So if in a disputed situation like this, where people disagree about how a big city like New York City should be policed, we have elections. And then, you know, when those elections decide the leadership of the city and the policy is changed, we can't have, you know, the police officers saying, oh, no, we're not going to change the policy. Now, I'm not saying they're saying that quite yet.
But it makes you worry about that. Because there is, to that extent, a parallel. I mean, we have elections. We elect a president. The president tells the soldiers what to do. Right. We have elections. We elect a mayor. The mayor, to some extent, sets policy for the police. Now, of course, the mayor has much less leeway. I mean, a mayor isn't going to say, OK, go invade this city. So in that sense, it's less troubling because the basic set of rules that govern the conduct of police day to day is much less prone to the discretion of the mayor than the behavior of troops is to the discretion of the president. But it's still, you know, it makes me a little queasy. You know, on the I mean, speaking of comparisons between domestic and foreign affairs, yeah. It occurred to me the you know, this disturbed guy who killed these two police. It made me realize, you know, how there is a kind of parallel with kind of the recruitment of jihadists, especially kind of homegrown terrorists.
Yeah, yeah.
In other words, whenever there is a cause that inspires people and could conceivably inspire them to violence, it's like a magnet for seriously alienated and disturbed and sometimes actually crazy people, right?
Right.
And these are by and large people who will not, you know, often with these movements, who will not be embraced by other people who stand for roughly the same cause, but they get attracted to them, and it just points to the cost of letting kind of causes fester, you know, the kinds of cause, you know, I guess it just makes me worry about positive feedback cycles of this sort in general, right? Where and leads me to one of my hopes, which is just that we on the foreign front, the United States will kind of quit helping to sustain causes that serve as a magnet for alienated and disturbed people who want to behead people and stuff. And it's not always easy to wind this stuff down in either of these cases, right? It's not easy to figure out what you do to drain the energy from the kind of cause, the movement that is attracting these people. But anyway, in a very abstract sense, it's my hope that we'll figure out a way to do it, I guess, on both fronts.
Yeah, that's a big ask there, Bob. I see the problem. I see the problem, which is that, you know, the threat is in part, in substantial part, from the way that these ideas are diffused and how people are reacting, you know, to events. And you know, there are a million different points at which something could go wrong. You know, a doctor in the army who identifies with the cause of the jihadist can take a weapon, mm-hmm. and, you know, just murder 20 or 15 people sitting in a barrack somewhere.
Fort Hood.
You know, exactly. Yeah. And other such things like that. And, you got all these people online sitting in their bedrooms in their pajamas, you know, reading whatever they're reading on these websites and is getting all worked up about this and that. And it's very hard to know how to effectively combat that. Certainly, you cannot infiltrate every mosque or, you know, meeting hall where people might be meeting. You can't have enough undercover operators to track down everybody who's having a thought. And it seems to me you have.
Well, also that fuels the fire beyond a point. I mean, yeah. that creates a grievance.
People react to that. And moreover,
right.
I think you have to worry about, you know, sort of criminalizing people's dissent. I mean, you know, how do you discriminate between a Somali immigrant in Minneapolis who's going to go off the deep end and, you know, want to go over to Syria and fight for ISIS or something like that, or come home and assassinate somebody, and a kid who is not going to do that, but who happens to identify with Muslims around the world and feel that they're being persecuted, whether it's in Kashmir or Chechnya or Palestine or Iraq and Syria? And who has that thought, which is a completely legitimate thought for a person to have. So, you know, every person who has that thought is not going to end up being a terrorist or a murderer. Everybody who thinks that, you know, white police are racist in the way in which they conduct themselves in American cities isn't going to end up killing somebody. So you can't view with suspicion everybody who expresses a political opinion, right. Seems to me. So it's a very difficult problem.
Yeah, it is. I mean, whenever these things happen, they look at the background of the person who committed the atrocity and say, well, gosh, why didn't somebody do something? You can see the signs. Well, there's a ton of people evincing those kinds of signs in America right now. You know, it's easy to look back and say this guy was clearly unstable, you know, but it's much, much harder to be prospective and figure out what really small minority of the highly unstable people in the world are going to do something truly atrocious. So that's tough.
Let me ask you about, since we're talking about what we hope for, what are you, I mean, and I know you do a lot of conversations with people about foreign affairs and whatnot. What are you, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's the Iran negotiations or it's Putin and Ukraine or it's peace in the Middle East or whatever, what are your hopes and fears for the year ahead?
Well, certainly I would like to see a deal, a nuclear deal with Iran. And I think if we don't see it this year, we're never going to see it, or we're not for years and years. And the situation will just kind of deteriorate. And of course, I'd love to see some kind of deal with Putin that would defuse this situation, while I guess ideally teaching people the right lessons. I mean, you would ideally not like to give Putin a lot of positive reinforcement. But I fear, you know, in both cases, it's interesting, in both cases with Iran and with Russia, we are trying to exert economic leverage with sanctions. In both cases, the sanctions have had some effect, and additional factors in both cases, including the decline in oil prices, have further exacerbated the economic troubles. So in both cases, in principle, according to kind of basic game theory, at least, you would have players who you would think are motivated to make a deal, right?
Yeah.
I worry that we will overplay our hand. And I worry that in both and fail to get a deal. And just kind of figure, well, we brought them to our knees. We'll just wait for them to eventually agree to everything we're demanding rather than make any additional compromises ourselves, especially in the Iran case. And I think the reason we might do that is because we're not sufficiently mindful of the political constraint, the domestic political constraints that their political actors are under. It's a common failing of people to appreciate, on the one hand, the domestic forces that constrain their own politicians, you know, the hardliners who are arguing things that make it impossible for Obama to go as far as he might like, say, while not appreciating that all these people are politicians. Putin is a politician who, above all, wants to stay in power. And same goes for the Iranian regime. And then there are additional complications within both systems. But I just think that if you follow your intuition and say, okay, you know, we're doing great, their economies are crumbling, we're going to wait for them to come crawling to us on their knees, it may never happen. And in the case of Iran, that would be especially unfortunate, I think, because a deal is clearly, you can easily visualize a deal that Iran would do and that would be way better from our point of view than no deal. But I'm not sure we're going to accept that.
Now, what role, let me just ask you about this, I don't know a lot about it, is the Israeli government playing in exercising, if not a veto, then a constraint on any deal making via the U.S. Congress, via the influence of the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. Congress? As I read the newspaper, I hear concerns expressed about that. Well, the president can try to do what he wants to do, but he has to look over his shoulder at what Congress is going to do. And I've heard this or that member of Congress in criticism of the process basically take the Israeli position that no deal is better than a bad deal, and a bad deal is one that leaves Iran in the position to be able to break out and acquire nuclear capacity in short order should it elect to do so, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, on the political question, I think most people who follow this closely in America would say that the Israel lobby, broadly speaking, is a very important factor here. Probably the main single identifiable factor that Obama is up against. And again, broadly speaking, not just AIPAC, but think tanks like the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and so on. Bill Kristol and so on. Yeah. They've worked hard to limit the political space of our negotiators to compromise in the way that I think will be necessary to get a deal. I think Obama has shown a reasonable amount of courage given everything, and he may be inclined to show more now that he's a true lame duck and there won't even be another, midterm election during his tenure. On the substantive question of breakout, I don't want to get too technical. We can link to a piece that I co-authored that appeared in Slate about this whole idea of breakout capacity. And the short answer is, look, Iran has the knowledge of how to build a bomb. You cannot, if they want to build one, you cannot prevent them in the long run with anything short of a ground invasion and occupation. Yeah. And I don't think we have the appetite for that. Yeah. So the question is really, how long do you want the breakout? How hard do you want to make it for them? And the thing is that the difference between what we are now willing to offer and what we know Iran would accept is like a difference of months. It's like, well, they could have a functioning warhead in a year versus they could have a functioning warhead in a year and 7 months or something like that. It's that kind of difference. Oh. And there's no practical difference between those two situations.
See. That's interesting.
In terms of our ability to preempt or at least delay things via bombing, we would have time to do that in either event. Yeah. And they, meanwhile, will in either event have whatever stature is accorded you by virtue of being a nation that can't, that everyone knows can build a bomb, right? So there's just, and this is why it seems reasonable to suspect that the people who are arguing that, we'll give them 4,000 centrifuges but not 5,000 or whatever, it seems reasonable to suspect that maybe their actual goal is to prevent a deal from happening at all, because the practical difference between, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 centrifuges is, to my mind, just almost non-existent.
So why is it in the interest to not have a deal from, I don't know, the point of view of the Israel lobby or the Netanyahu government or whatever? Why, if that is what we might end up suspecting to be their motive to prevent a deal altogether, would that be a good thing for them? So there must be another shoe to drop here. If there's no deal, then what? Then bombing something or invading something?
Well, I think it's not clear that everyone who's kind of opposed to a deal has thought this through clearly, what they would do. As for what motivates them to be so fearful of a deal, the official line is, well, Iran, with a nuclear weapon would like nuke Israel or something. I think, that's kind of crazy. Iran actually has behaved, you look at their behavior, they're actually quite rational in terms of the way they conduct themselves in foreign affairs. They definitely support groups like Hezbollah, but not in some kind of suicidal way, right? There's no signs at all that they would do something that would, like, attack a nuclear power, right? So, I think a lot of it has to do more with regional geopolitics. In Israel, Iran is probably the greatest single potential threat just for regional hegemony, right?
Yeah.
Just in terms of a country with the potential to be very prosperous and powerful, and a country who currently seems to be an enemy of Israel's. That's kind of their biggest concern, I mean, compared to Saudi Arabia, anybody else, it's just not even close, right? If you look at the actual potential of Iran, given its various kinds of resources.
Right.
So I think a lot of people think that's really the issue. And so at that point, the question becomes, well, if Iran were drawn back into the world, so to speak. You relieve the sanctions and so on. You've got a moderate regime now that would take credit for the deal and would get some credit for that domestically. Would a more prosperous and powerful Iran have to remain a bitter enemy of Israel's? And would that be more than a nominal thing? Would it pose an actual threat to Israel, or would it be more like a rhetorical thing where they mouth the platitudes, the anti-Israel platitudes, and so on? And there, people have differing views, and maybe I'm too optimistic, but I don't actually think Iran is any kind of existential threat to Israel. In fact, Robert Kaplan, I think, not Kagan, important distinction,
yeah,
but Robert Kaplan, who was more of a realist, yeah, and not a neocon, I just put a piece in The Atlantic that I haven't read yet that I think makes the case that a deal with Iran would actually be good for Israel. So we can link to that.
Huh.
But that's... As you may be able to tell, I've actually paid a fair amount of attention to this, and it's been a source of real frustration. But there is, I would say there's a 50-50 chance of a deal, and it would be a good thing. I think in the long run for Israel too.
All right.
So we'll see. Let's see what other hopes and fears. Russia's a dicier. I don't know. What is your – do you have big hopes, fears on the foreign front?
No, I don't. I'm an observer of what's going on. Are we going to be at war against terrorism forever?
That's my fear.
There's this fear of this kind of – routinization, institutionalization, regularization, kind of, digging it in, yeah, and making this kind of just a part of who we are and what we do going forward without there being, right, any way out. That's, I don't know that that's a very coherent, I'm not sure what I'm against or what I'm for by saying it, but I do worry that we seem to be just sliding into this posture of, yeah, just being permanently at war, permanently driven by our fear of enemies, permanently at a kind of negotiating our freedoms and liberties over and against the imperatives of a security state, and with our forces deployed all around the world and constantly killing our enemies and engendering new enemies in the process of doing so, and
right,
so
that's the key. I think that's the key phrase right there, because that's what makes it a positive feedback cycle, that we are engendering new enemies. And I wish we would realize that in many ways the enemy here is just hatred. We shouldn't think of the enemy as individual people we need to kill. We should think of the enemy as creating reasons that, with or without justice, with or without reasons, without logic, make more Muslims hate us, right? And I worry, like you, that we're locked into this positive feedback cycle where, we keep killing people with drone strikes, and every once in a while we kill civilians and children, and then jihadist propagandists use that to recruit more people. I was kind of concerned with how easily Obama was drawn into what he himself described as a full-scale war with ISIS. It's one thing to intervene and say, we'll do what we can. You could say, we're gonna do some bombing to try to do some containing, but ultimately there are other people in this region that have a stake in this, and the real question is, are they going to pitch in? And we can't control that, and we'll see. But he really virtually declared war and staked his own legacy to the actual extinction of this group.
Yeah.
It was just such a major commitment, and one that, again, can be construed by propagandists as declaring war on Islam. He declared war on something called the Islamic State, rightly or wrongly, and I think wrongly, but that's what it calls itself. And we're just so casual now about a few more drone strikes here. This is our new war. It's concerning to me.
Did the president have a choice, given that ISIS was on the move and was rolling back the gains that that we had made in Iraq, you know, taking over this town, that town, and so on. Did the president have, who, you know, was campaigning and then governing with the idea of ending these wars and getting out, and his opponents are saying, you know, blood and treasure were expended for, you know, Fallujah, Anbar Providence, whatever. And now it's all being rolled back on your watch. What are you going to do about it? I mean, could he really have reacted with equanimity, you know, and said, well, you know, we can't control everything. And, you know, we'll try to support the Iraqis, but, you know, and the Kurds. But,
well, I think I agree he had almost no political choice but to do some kind of intervention. I mean, again, you can always just say, I don't care about the polls, and I don't care how much red meat we feed the conservatives, but almost any politician, I think, would have felt pretty much compelled to do something. But that's not really what I'm taking issue. I'm taking issue with how he described it, the magnitude of the commitment he made. And also the sheer hyperbole that was emanating from his administration. I mean, Chuck Hagel called it, I don't know, something like the biggest threat ever to every interest we have, just something crazy. And it seems to me that the president's job, especially in the predicament we find ourselves in, where we face a possibly endless war on terror that just feeds on itself, should be to calm people down whenever possible and keep things in perspective. And he didn't really do any of that. He could have done that, too. He could have said, let's keep our head about us. There are reasons that these guys cannot take over the region, okay? Let's calm down. But we're going to do something. And we're going to hope that we can get some other people in the region to do other things. And we'll keep it under control. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But you tell me, what else? I mean, one kind of broad question I have is in general, with the kinds of things that worry you and me, is the hope more at the political level or at the almost moral or even spiritual level? In other words, you know what I mean? I mean, is it so much acts of legislation and specific foreign policy decisions, or is it changing the way people, broadly speaking, kind of think about things? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that. I find myself often, whatever the issue might be, climate change or you know, health care reform or whatever, thinking, you know, clever, quick fixes and, you know, marginal remedies are much less, you know, promising than, you know, fundamental. So in the area of climate change, you know, we all want to get on an airplane and fly off to, well, this time of year, someplace where, you know, the sun is shining, the temperature is 75 degrees and the water is blue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have a way of life. We've got our automobiles, we've got our air conditioners, we got, you know, and everybody has this notion of what development, prosperity, you know, happiness consists of. And it's very dependent upon an economy and a kind of ecology that is threatening and maybe not sustainable. And, you know, we can fiddle around the margins, you know, with carbon taxes and restrictions on, you know, coal use and various things like that, or we can address ourselves kind of to the heart of the matter, which is, you know, can we be happy without getting on an airplane and traveling 3,000 miles for a 2-week vacation? And so, you know, thinking that a change of consciousness is really the only way out of this problem in the long run is a tempting thought. And, you know, maybe more prosaically, but in the similar spirit, you know, I'm thinking, well, everybody should have health care. You know, we've got this kind of Rube Goldberg complex scheme about insurance subsidy to ensure that everybody gets health care without, you know, upsetting the basic structure of how health care is provided and how it's paid for. Whereas the value commitment of, you know, social solidarity that says no one should live in the society and not be able to expect to be taken care of when they become ill, and that we're all in this together, and that's a social commitment mm-hmm. that has to be paid for. You know, we don't quite ever explicitly argue that, and so we never actually transform people's consciousness around those issues. They continue to sort of think about themselves as monads, each man for himself, and so on, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, and not to go on too long about that, I get this distinction between policy fixes and politics on the one hand, and transformations of the way we deal with each other, certainly on the race relations front, you know, community and of color and police conflict and all like that. We can think about body cameras or, you know, what a district attorney gets to do if a policeman gets charged with a crime or whatever. And those things can be altered, but you somehow imagine that only if one has a deeper change in the way in which people are thinking about one another, police officers and members of a community, can this problem really be solved. But we know how to do policy and law. We don't know how to do transformation of consciousness. So practical conversation almost always gravitates toward the former.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, there was some hope that Obama would be the kind of president who might make some progress on this front, you know? And I think he tried. I guess I don't think many people think he has succeeded in a big way, right?
No, I admit to being disappointed, although it's kind of unfair to blame this on Obama since he's just one functionary within a complex system. But, you know, mm-hmm. the campaign was so hopeful, you know, hope and change. It was so full of this idea that we're one America, not black, we're not white, we're not red, we're not blue, we're not north, we're not south. We're one America. There was this idea of transformation, youthful, you know, new generation kind of idea. And here we are, you know, three quarters of the way through the Obama presidency, and we seem to be beset on every side by old style conflict. And, you know, talk about visionary transformation and all of that, a remaking of our consciousnesses has long since been set to the side. And I can't help but feel disappointed about that, although I think it's probably clear in retrospect that the prospects of hope and change were oversold during that campaign of 2008.
Yeah, and it's clear to me that his own ethnic identity is in some ways a handicap, even if in some ways it's an asset. I mean, I think when he talks about race, he's viewed with more suspicion by some people than he would be if he were white. Just as a white politician would be viewed with more suspicion by other people when he talks about race. So it's a tough nut to crack. I mean, he did the healthcare legislation, however meager relative to original expectations, is there.
Yep.
Probably won't be out and out repealed, and maybe it can be built upon to become more comprehensive, which won't please everyone, but would please liberals, Obama's constituency. So it's not like he's done nothing.
No.
But I guess maybe a transformation of consciousness is a lot to ask of anyone.
It would appear so, yeah.
So I don't know. Any other closing thoughts on hopes? I have one final hope. One final hobby horse I'll get on briefly, but should I do my hobby horse first and then we'll see if you have any more?
Yeah. I think I might be exhausted here, Bob, but let's hear yours.
Okay, mine is just global governance, just realizing the number of cases in which it's in the interest of nations broadly to work out rules of the road, or, I mean, like in the case of cyber warfare, the U.S. with this Stuxnet attack on Iran set a very grave precedent, I think, that puts us in a kind of a poorer position to complain about whoever did this to Sony.
Right.
And I think... just as with a regular arms, nuclear arms, I think it would be good to see what we can do in the way of establishing global norms and laws that would constrain things on that front. I think Ebola shows us that the World Health Organization could have been in more robust shape when that happened and could have been more on top of things. And this is just an old hobby horse of mine about how the logic behind some forms of governance moving to the global level grows with time as relations among nations become more non-zero sum for technological reasons. So I say that periodically, and it fails to happen. So maybe I should quit saying it in hopes that finally it would happen. But anyway, that's my hobby horse. Any other?
Well, do you include targeted assassination and, you know, this kind of?
Yeah, it really troubles me. Yeah. That's another area where we have very casually entered a whole new age.
Yeah.
Where we just pick guys, you know, we consider threats in whatever country they may be in. I mean, I suppose that's not quite true. We there's some countries we would not use drone strikes in, but you know, it's an act of war to kill someone, to kill a citizen of a country without the express approval of that government, and we have done that. Right. And you know, yeah, that bothers me tremendously. And this is maybe my biggest disappointment in Obama, is in how many cases he has seemed not mindful of the need to nurture global norms and sustain and develop international law. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we agree about that.
Okay. But hey, we should close in directing people to this piece in Slate by Steve Pinker and somebody else arguing that things are better than ever. We'll include a link to that. I haven't read it, but I'd love to be convinced. And I think in terms of deaths, you know, violent deaths per living person, numbers don't look bad by historical terms. It's these positive feedback cycles that worry me, the negative positive feedback cycles.
That's interesting.
So,
you know, a game theorist could go a long way with that. That's very provocative to people who do the kind of stuff that I do. Yeah.
You mean,
you know, in terms of an analytic framework, you know, about how systems can get out of whack because of, you know, positive feedbacks that reinforce, you know, unfortunate behaviors, you know. Anyway, I'm sorry that I don't have time to explain what I'm saying if it wasn't clear.
Well, yeah, but I encourage you to devote the rest of your career to it, Glenn.
Okay. I'll give that some thought.
You have my approval. And also you have my thanks for all the time you spend putting the Glenn Show together on Blogging Heads.
My pleasure, Bob. It's one of the things I really look forward to doing, too. You know, if it wasn't for that, I'd have to go to my office and do some real work.
We wouldn't want that. No. if it's that, you know, if it's either do Blogging Heads or grade papers, it's pretty clear what we do.
Yeah.
The choice is clear.
I think it's like, okay, well, what is it, 7-8 years that I've been doing Blogging Heads now, Bob, almost from the very beginning.
Blogging Heads is, yeah, at least, I would suspect your first appearance is at least 8 years ago, because we've now entered our 10th year. November will be our 10-year anniversary. Uh-huh. And I think you were on board pretty early, because Josh Cohen actually brought you on.
Josh Cohen brought me on. That's
right. And he was on early. You had written something for the Boston Review.
That's right. 2007.
Was that was 2000? Okay. So it's only been,
seven and a half years,
well,
maybe. Yeah.
Seven and a half years. Okay. Well, that's not nothing.
No.
Here's to another 7.5. And thanks again, and have a happy new year, and enjoy the holidays with your family.
Same to you, Robert.
Okay, take care.
Take care, bye.